He got it from his father, with the blood. He knows he is a king's son, but chooses to forget that he is bastard-born, and he worships Robert, as Renly did when he was young. My royal brother played the fond father on his visits to Storm's End, and there were gifts, swords and ponies and fur-trimmed cloaks. The eunuchs work, every one. The boy would write the Red Keep full of thanks, and Robert would laugh and ask Varys what he had sent this year. Renly was no better. He left the boy's upbringing to castellans and maesters, and every one fell victim to his charm. Penrose chose to die rather than give him up. The king ground his teeth together. It still angers me. How could he think I would hurt the boy? I chose Robert, did I not? When that hard day came, I chose blood over honour. He does not use the boy's name. That made Davos very uneasy. I hope young Edric will recover soon. Stannis waved a hand, dismissing his concern. It is a chill, no more. He coughs, he shivers, he has a fever. Maester Pylos will soon set him right. By himself the boy is naught, you understand? But in his veins flows my brother's blood. There is power in a king's blood, she says. Davos did not have to ask who she was. Stannis touched the painted table. Look at it, Onion Knight. My realm, by rights, my Westeros. He swept a hand across it. This talk of seven kingdoms is a folly. Aegon saw that 300 years ago, when he stood where we are standing. They painted this table at his command. Rivers and bays they painted, hills and mountains, castles and cities and market towns, lakes and swamps and forests, but no borders. It is all one. One realm. For one king to rule alone. One king, agreed Davos. One king means peace. I shall bring justice to Westeros, a thing Sir Axel understands as little as he does war. Claw Isle would gain me naught, and it was evil, just as you said. Celtigar must pay the traitor's price himself in his own person, and when I come into my kingdom he shall. Every man shall reap what he has sown, from the highest lord to the lowest gutter rat. And some will lose more than the tips off their fingers, I promise you. They have made my kingdom bleed, and I do not forget that. King Stannis turned from the table. On your knees, Onion Knight. Your grace. For your onions and fish, I made you a knight once. For this, I am of a mind to raise you to lord. This? Davos was lost. I am content to be your knight, your grace. I would not know how to begin being lordly. Good. To be lordly is to be false. I have learned that lesson hard. Now kneel. Your king commands. Davos knelt, and Stannis drew his longsword. Lightbringer, Melisandre had named it. The red sword of heroes, drawn from the fires where the seven guards were consumed. The room seemed to grow brighter as the blade slid from its scabbard. The steel had a glow to it, now orange, now yellow, now red. The air shimmered around it, and no jewel had ever sparkled so brilliantly. But when Stannis touched it to Davos's shoulder, it felt no different than any other longsword. "Sir Davos of House Seaworth," the king said, "are you my true and honest liegeman, now and forever?"
I am, your grace.
And do you swear to serve me loyally all your days, to give me honest counsel and swift obedience, to defend my rights and my realm against all foes in battles great and small, to protect my people and punish my enemies?
I do, your grace.
Then rise again, Davos Seaworth, and rise as Lord of the Rainwood, Admiral of the Narrow Sea, and Hand of the King. For a moment, Davos was too stunned to move.
I woke this morning in his dungeon.
Your Grace, you cannot. I am no fit man to be a king's hand. There is no man fitter. Davos sheathed Lightbringer, gave Davos his hand, and pulled him to his feet.
I am low-born, Davos reminded him. An up-jump smuggler. Your lords will never obey me.
Then we will make new lords.
But I cannot read, nor write.
Maester Pylos can read for you. As to writing, my last hand wrote the head off his shoulders. All I ask of you are the things you've always given me. Honesty, loyalty, service.
Surely there's someone better, some great lord.
Stannis snorted. Bar Eamon, that boy, my faithless grandfather. Celtigar has abandoned me. The new Valyrian is 6 years old, and the new Sunglass sailed for Volantis after I burned his brother. He made an angry gesture. A few good men remain, it's true. Sir Gilbert Faring holds Storm's End for me still, with 200 loyal men. Lord Morrigan, the bastard of Nightsong, young Chittering, my cousin Andrew. But I trust none of them, as I trust you, my Lord of Rainwood. You will be my hand. It is you I want beside me for the battle.
Another battle will be the end of all of us, thought Davos. Lord Alistair saw that much true enough. Your Grace asked for honest counsel. In honesty, then, we lack the strength for another battle against the Lannisters.
It is the great battle His Grace is speaking of, said a woman's voice, rich with the accents of the East.
Melisande stood at the door, in her red silks and shimmering satins, holding a covered silver dish in her hands.
These little wars are no more than the scuffle of children before what is to come. The one whose name may not be spoken is marshalling his power, Davos Seaworth, a power fell and evil and strong beyond measure. Soon comes the cold and the night that never ends.
She placed the silver dish on the painted table.
Unless true men find the courage to fight it, men whose hearts are fire.
Stannis stared at the silver dish. She has shown it to me, Lord Davos, in the flames.
You saw it, sire?
It was not like Stannis Baratheon to lie about such a thing. With mine own eyes. After the battle, when I was lost to despair, the Lady Melisande bid me gaze into the hearth fire. The chimney was drawing strongly, and bits of ash were rising from the fire. I stared at them, feeling half a fool, but she bid me look deeper, and the ashes were white, rising in the updraft. Yet all at once it seemed as if they were falling. Snow, I thought. Then the sparks in the air seemed to circle, to become a ring of torches, and I was looking through the fire, down on some high hill in a forest. The cinders had become men in black behind the torches, and there were shapes moving through the snow. For all the heat of the fire, I felt a cold, so terrible I shivered. But when I did, the sight was gone. The fire, but a fire once again. But what I saw was real. I'd stake my kingdom on it.
And have, said Melisande.
The conviction in the king's voice frightened Davos to the core.
A hill in a forest? Shapes in the snow? I don't.
It means that the battle is begun, said Melisande. The sand is running through the glass more quickly now, and man's hour on earth is almost done. We must act boldly, or all hope is lost. Westeros must unite beneath her one true king, the prince that was promised, Lord of Dragonstone, and chosen of R'hllor.
R'hllor chooses queerly, then, the king grimaced, as if he tasted something foul. Why me, and not my brothers? Renly and his peach. In my dreams I could see the juice running from his mouth, the blood from his throat. If he had done his duty by his brother, we would have smashed Lord Tywin. A victory even Robert could be proud of, Robert, his teeth ground side to side, is in my dreams as well, laughing, drinking, boasting. Those were the things he was best at. Those, and fighting. I never bested him at anything. The Lord of Light should have made Robert his champion. Why me?
Because you are a righteous man, said Melisande.
A righteous man. Stannis touched the covered silver platter with a finger. With leeches.
Yes, said Melisande. But I must tell you once more, this is not the way.
You swore it would work. The king looked angry.
It will, and it will not.
Which?
Both.
Speak sense to me, woman.
When the fire speak more plainly, so shall I. There is truth in the flames, but is not always easy to see.
The great red ruby at her throat drank fire from the glow of the brazier.
Give me the boy, your grace. It is the surer way, the better way. Give me the boy, and I shall wake the stone dragon.
I've told you no.
He is only one base-born boy, against all the boys of Westeros, and all the girls as well, against all the children that might ever be born in all the kingdoms of the world.
The boy is innocent.
The boy defiled your marriage-bed, else you would surely have sons of your own. He shamed you.
Robert did that, not the boy. My daughter's grown fond of him, and is mine own blood.
Your brother's blood,
Melisande said.
A king's blood. Only a king's blood can wake the stone dragon.
Stannis ground his teeth. I'll hear no more of this. The dragons are done. The Targaryens tried to bring them back half a dozen times, and made fools of themselves, all corpses. Patchface is the only fool we need on this godforsaken rock. You have the leeches. Do your work.
Melisande bowed her head stiffly and said, As my king commands.
Reaching up her left sleeve with her right hand, she flung a handful of powder into the brazier. The coals roared. As pale flames writhed atop them, the Red Woman retrieved the silver dish and brought it to the king. Davos watched her lift the lid. Beneath were three large black leeches, fat with blood.
The boy's blood, Davos knew. A king's blood.
Stannis stretched forth a hand, and his fingers closed around one of the leeches.
Say the name, Melisande commanded.
The leech was twisting in the king's grip, trying to attach itself to one of his fingers. The usurper, he said, Joffrey Baratheon. When he tossed the leech into the fire, it curled up like an autumn leaf amidst the coals and burned. Stannis grasped the second. The usurper, he declared, louder this time. Balon Greyjoy! He flipped it lightly onto the brazier, and its flesh spit and cracked. The blood burst from it, hissing and smoking. The last was in the king's hand. This one he studied a moment as it writhed between his fingers. The usurper, he said at last. Robb Stark. And he threw it on the flames. Jaime. Harrenhal's bathhouse was a dim, steamy, low-ceilinged room filled with great stone tubs. When they led Jaime in, they found Brienne seated in one of them, scrubbing her arm almost angrily. "Not so hard, wench," he called. "You'll scrub the skin off." She dropped her brush and covered her tits with hands as big as Gregor Clegane's. The pointy little buds she was so intent on hiding would have looked more natural on some 10-year-old than they did on her thick, muscular chest.
"What are you doing here?"
she demanded. "Lord Bolton insists I sup with him, but he neglected to invite my fleas." Jaime tugged at his guard with his left hand. "Help me out of these stinking rags." One-handed, he could not so much as unlace his breeches. The man obeyed grudgingly, but he obeyed. "Now leave us," Jamie said when his clothes lay in a pile on the wet stone floor. "My Lady of Tarth doesn't want the likes of you scum gaping at her tits." He pointed his stump at the hatchet-faced woman attending Brian. "You two, wait without. There's only one door, and the wench is too big to try and shinny up a chimney." The habit of obedience went deep. The woman followed his guard out, leaving the bathhouse to the two of them. The tubs were large enough to hold six or seven, after the fashion of the free cities, so Jamie climbed in with the wench, awkward and slow. Both his eyes were open, though the right remained somewhat swollen, despite Kyburn's leeches. Jamie felt 109 years old, which was a deal better than he had been feeling when he came to Harrenhal. Brian shrunk away from him. "There are other tubs." "This one suits me well enough." Gingerly, he immersed himself up to the chin in the steaming water. "Have no fear, wench. Your thighs are purple and green, and I am not interested in what you've got between them." He had to rest his right arm on the rim, since Kyburn had warned him to keep the linen dry. He could feel the tension drain from his legs, but his head spun. "If I faint, pull me out. No Lannister has ever drowned in his bath, and I don't mean to be the first." "Why should I care how you die?" "You swore a solemn vow." He smiled as a red flush crept up the thick white column of her neck. She turned her back to him. "Still the shy maiden. What is it that you think I haven't seen?" He groped for the brush she had dropped, caught it with his fingers, and began to scrub himself desultorily. Even that was difficult, awkward. "My left hand is good for nothing." Still the water darkened as the cake dirt dissolved off his skin. The wench kept her back to him, the muscles in her great shoulders hunched and hard. "Does the sight of my stump distress you so?" Jamie asked. "You ought to be pleased. I've lost the hand I killed the king with, the hand that flung the Stark boy from that tower, the hand I'd slide between my sister's thighs to make her wet." He thrust his stump at her face. "No wonder Renly died, with you guarding him." She jerked to her feet as if it struck her, sending a wash of hot water across the tub. Jamie caught a glimpse of the thick blonde bush at the juncture of her thighs as she climbed out. She was much hairier than his sister. Absurdly, he felt his cock stir beneath the bathwater. "Now I know I've been too long away from Cersei." He averted his eyes, troubled by his body's response. "That was unworthy," he mumbled. "I'm a maimed man, and bitter. Forgive me, wench. You protected me as well as any man could have, and better than most." She wrapped her nakedness in a towel. "Do you mock me?" That pricked him back to anger. "Are you as thick as a castle wall? That was an apology. I'm tired of fighting with you. What say we make a truce?" "Truces are built on trust. Would you have me trust the Kingslayer, yes? The oathbreaker who murdered poor sad Aerys Targaryen?" Jamie snorted. "It's not Aerys I rue, it's Robert. I hear they have named you Kingslayer," he said to me at his coronation feast. "Just don't think to make it a habit." And he laughed. "Why is it that no one names Robert Oathbreaker? He tore the realm apart, yet I am the one with shit for honor. Robert did all he did for love." Water ran down Brian's legs and pooled beneath her feet. "Robert did all he did for pride, a cunt, and a pretty face. He made a fist, or would have, if he'd had a hand." Pain lanced off his arm, cruel as laughter. "He rode to save the realm," she insisted. "To save the realm. Did you know that my brother set the Blackwater Rush afire? Wildfire will burn on water. Aerys would have bathed in it if he dared. The Targaryens were all mad for fire." Jamie felt light-headed. "It is the heat in here, the poison in my blood. The last, my fever. I am not myself. He eased himself down until the water reached his chin. Soiled my white cloak. I wore my gold armor that day, but... Gold armor? Her voice sounded far off, faint. He floated in heat, in memory. After Dancing Griffins lost the Battle of the Bells, Ares exiled him. Why am I telling this absurd, ugly child? He had finally realized that Robert was no mere outlaw lord to be crushed at whim, but the greatest threat House Targaryen had faced since Daemon Blackfyre. The king reminded Luan Martell gracelessly that he held Aelia and sent him to take command of the 10,000 Dornishmen coming up the king's road. John Darry and Barristan Selmy rode to Stony Sept to rally what they could of Griffin's men, and Prince Rhaegar returned from the south and persuaded his father to swallow his pride and summon my father. But no raven returned from Castle Rock, and that made the king even more afraid. He saw traitors everywhere, and Varys was always there to point out any he might have missed. So his grace commanded his alchemists to place caches of wildfire all over King's Landing. Beneath Baelor's Sept, and in the hovels of Flea Bottom, under stables and storehouses, at all seven gates, even in the cellars of the Red Keep itself. Everything was done in the utmost secrecy by a handful of master pyromancers. They did not even trust their own acolytes to help. The queen's eyes had been closed for years, and Rhaegar was busy marshalling an army, but Ares knew Mace and Dagger Hand was not utterly stupid, and with Rossart, Belis, and Garrigus coming and going night and day, he became suspicious. Chelsted, that was his name, Lord Chelsted. It had come back to him suddenly with the telling. I thought the man craven, but the day he confronted Ares, he found some courage somewhere. He did all he could to dissuade him. He reasoned, he jested, he threatened, and finally he begged. When that failed, he took off his chain of office and flung it down on the floor. Ares burned him alive for that, and hung his chain about the neck of Rossart, his favourite pyromancer, the man who had cooked Lord Rickard Stark in his own armour. And all that time I stood by the foot of the Iron Throne in my white plate, still as a corpse, guarding my liege and all his sweet secrets. My sworn brothers were all away, you see, but Ares liked to keep me close. I was my father's son, so he did not trust me. He wanted me where Varys could watch me day and night. So I heard it all. He remembered how Rossart's eyes would shine when he unrolled his maps to show where the substance must be placed. Garrigus and Belis were the same. Rhaegar met Robert on the Trident, and you know what happened there. When the word reached court, Ares packed the queen off to Dragonstone with Prince Viserys. Princess Aelia would have gone as well, but he forbade it. Somehow he had gotten it in his head that Prince Luin must have betrayed Rhaegar on the Trident. But he thought he could keep Dorn loyal so long as he kept Aelia and Aegon by his side. "The traitors want my city," I heard him tell Rossart. "But I'll give them naught but ashes. Let Robert be king over charred bones and cooked meat." The Targaryens never bury their dead, they burn them. Ares meant to have the greatest funeral pyre of them all. Though, if truth be told, I do not believe he truly expected to die. Like Aerion Brightfire before him, Ares thought the fire would transform him, that he would rise again, reborn as a dragon, and turn all his enemies to ash. Ned Stark was racing south with Robert's van, but my father's forces reached the city first. Pycelle convinced the king that his warden of the west had come to defend him, so he opened the gates. The one time he should have heeded Varys, and he ignored him. My father had held back from the war, brooding on all the wrongs Ares had done him, and determined that House Lannister should be on the winning side. The trident decided him. It fell to me to hold the Red Keep, but I knew we were lost. I sent to Ares asking his leave to make terms. My man came back with a royal command. Bring me your father's head if you are no traitor. Ares would have no yielding. Lord Rossart was with him, my messenger said. I knew what that meant. When I came on Rossart, he was dressed as a common man-at-arms, hurrying to a postern gate. I slew him first. Then I slew Ares, before he could find someone else to carry his message to the pyromancers. Days later, I hunted down the others and slew them as well. Belus offered me gold, and Garrigus wept for mercy. Well, a sword's more merciful than fire, but I don't think Garrigus much appreciated the kindness I showed him. The water had grown cool. When Jamie opened his eyes, he found himself staring at the stump of his sword hand. The hand that made me Kingslayer. The goat had robbed him of his glory and his shame, both at once. Leaving what? Who am I now? The wench looked ridiculous, clutching her towel to her meagre tits with her thick white leg sticking out beneath. Has my tale turned you speechless? Come, curse me, or kiss me, or call me a liar, something. If this is true, how is it no one knows? The knights of the King's Guard are sworn to keep the King's secrets. Would you have me break my oath? Jamie laughed. Do you think the noble Lord of Winterfell wanted to hear my feeble explanations? Such an honourable man. He only had to look at me to judge me guilty. Jamie lurched to his feet, the water running cold on his chest. By what right does a wolf judge the lion? By what right? A violent shiver took him, and he smashed his stump against the rim of the tub as he tried to climb out. Pain shuddered through him, and suddenly the bathhouse was spinning. Brienne caught him before he could fall. Her arm was all goose-flesh, clammy and chilled, but she was strong, and gentler than he would have thought. Gentler than Cersei, he thought, as she helped him from the tub, his legs wobbly as a limp cock. "Guards!" he heard the wench shout. "The Kingslayer!" "Jamie," he thought. "My name is Jamie." The next he knew, he was lying on the damp floor with the guards and the wench and Qyburn all standing over him looking concerned. Brienne was naked, but she seemed to have forgotten that for the moment. "The heat of the tubs will do it," Maester Qyburn was telling them. "No, he's not a maester. They took his chain. There's still poison in his blood as well, and he's malnourished. What have you been feeding him?" "And piss and grave vomit," offered Jamie. "Hard bread and water and oat porridge," insisted the guard. "He don't hardly eat it, though. What shall we do with him?"
"Scrub him and dress him and carry him to King's Pyre if need be," Qyburn said. "Lord Bolton insists he will sup with him tonight. The time is growing short." "Bring me clean garb for him," Brienne said. "I'll see he's washed and dressed."
The others were all too glad to give her the task. They lifted him to his feet and sat him on a stone bench by the wall. Brienne went away to retrieve her towel and returned with a stiff brush to finish scrubbing him. One of the guards gave her a razor to trim his beard. Qyburn returned with rough-spun, small clothes, clean black woolen breeches, a loose green tunic, and a leather jerkin that laced up the front. Jamie was feeling less dizzy by then, though no less clumsy. With the wench's help, he managed to dress himself. "Now all I need is a silver looking-glass." The bloody maester had brought fresh clothing for Brienne as well, a stained pink satin gown and a linen under-tunic.
"I'm sorry, my lady. These were the only woman's garments in Harrenhal large enough to fit you."
It was obvious at once that the gown had been cut for someone with slimmer arms, shorter legs, and much fuller breasts. The fine Moorish lace did little to conceal the bruising that mottled Brienne's skin. All in all, the garb made the wench look ludicrous.
"She has thicker shoulders than I do, and a bigger neck," Jamie thought.
Small wonder if she prefers to dress in mail. Pink was not a kind colour for her, either. A dozen cruel japes leaped into his head, but for once he kept them there. Best not to make her angry. He was no match for her one-handed. Qyburn had brought a flask as well. "What is it?" Jamie demanded, when the chainless maester pressed him to drink.
"Licorice steeped in vinegar, with honey and cloves. It will give you some strength and clear your head."
"Bring me the potion that grows new hands," said Jamie. "That's the one I want."
"Drink it,"
Brian said, unsmiling, and he did. It was half an hour before he felt strong enough to stand. After the dim, wet warmth of the bathhouse, the air outside was a slap across the face.
"My lord will be looking for him by now," a guard told Qyburn. "Urchu, do I need to carry him?"
"I can still walk. Brain, give me your arm." Clutching her, Jamie let them herd him across a yard to a vast, draughty hall, larger even than the throne room in King's Landing. Huge hearths lined the walls, one every 10 feet or so, more than he could count. But no fires had been lit, so the chill between the walls went bone deep. A dozen spearmen, in fur cloaks, guarded the doors and the steps that led up to the two galleries above. And in the centre of that immense emptiness, at a trestle table, surrounded by what seemed like acres of smooth slate floor, the Lord of the Dreadfort waited, attended only by a cupbearer.
"My lord,"
said Brian, when they stood before him. Roose Bolton's eyes were paler than stone, darker than milk, and his voice was spider-soft.
"I am pleased that you are strong enough to attend this, sir. My lady, do be seated."
He gestured at the spread of cheese, bread, cold meat, and fruit that covered the table.
"Will you drink red or white?" "Of indifferent vintage, I fear. Sir Amory drained Lady Wenceslas nearly dry."
"I trust you killed him for it." Jamie slid into the offered seat quickly, so Bolton could not see how weak he was. "White is for Starks. I'll drink red, like a good Lannister."
"I would prefer water," said Brian. "Elmar, the red for Sir Jamie, water for the Lady Brian, and Hippocras for myself."
Bolton waved a hand at their escort, dismissing them, and the men beat a silent retreat. Habit made Jamie reach for the wine with his right hand. His stump rocked the goblet, spattering the clean linen bandages with bright red spots and forcing him to catch the cup with his left hand before it fell. But Bolton pretended not to notice his clumsiness. The Northman helped himself to a prune and ate it with small sharp bites.
"Do try these, Sir Jamie. They are most sweet. And help move the boughs as well. Lord Vargo took them from an inn before he burnt it."
"My boughs move fine, that goat's no lord, and your prunes don't interest me half as much as your intentions."
"Regarding you,"
a faint smile touched Roose Bolton's lips,
"you are a perilous prize, sir. You sow dissension wherever you go, even here in my happy house of Harrenhal."
His voice was a whisker above a whisper.
"And in River Run as well, it seems. Do you know Edmure Tully has offered 1,000 golden dragons for your recapture?"
"Is that all?"
"My sister will pay 10 times as much."
"Will she?" That smile again, there for an instant, gone as quick.
10,000 dragons is a formidable sum. Of course, there is Lord Carstark's offer to consider as well. He promises the hand of his daughter to the man who brings him your head."
"Leave it to your goat to get it backward," said Jamie. Bolton gave a soft chuckle.
"Harry and Carstark was captive here when we took the castle, did you know? I gave him all the Carhold men still with me, and sent him off with Glover. I do hope nothing ill befell him at Duskendale, else Alice Carstark would be all that remains of Lord Rickard's progeny."
He chose another prune.
"Fortunately for you, I have no need of a wife.
I wed the Lady Walda Frere whilst I was at the Twins.
Farewell done.
Awkwardly, Jamie tried to hold the bread with his stump while tearing it with his left hand.
Fat Walda,
my Lord of Frere offered me my bride's weight in silver for a dowry, so I chose accordingly. Elmer, break off some bread for Sir Jamie. The boy tore a fist-sized chunk off one end of the loaf and handed it to Jamie. Brian tore her own bread.
Lord Bolton, she asked, it is said you mean to give Harrenhal to Vargo Holt.
That was his price, Lord Bolton said. The Lannisters are not the only men who pay their debts. I must take my leave soon in any case. Edmure Tully is to wed Lady Rosalind Frey at the Twins, and my king commands my attendance.
Edmure weds, said Jamie, not Rob Stark.
His Grace King Rob is wed. Bolton spit a prune pit into his hand and put it aside. To a westerling of the crag, I'm told her name is Jane. No doubt you know her, sir. Her father is your father's bannerman.
My father has a good many bannermen, and most of them have daughters.
Jamie groped one-handed for his goblet, trying to recall this Jane. The Westerlings were an old house, with more pride than power.
This cannot be true, Brian said stubbornly. King Rob was sworn to wed a Frey. He would never break faith.
His Grace is a boy of 16, said Roose Bolton mildly, and I would thank you not to question my word, my lady. Jamie felt almost sorry for Rob Stark. He won the war on a battlefield, and lost it in a bedchamber, poor fool.
How does Lord Walder relish dining on trout in place of wolf? He asked.
Oh, trout makes for a tasty supper.
Bolton lifted a pale finger toward his cupbearer.
Though my poor Elmar is bereft, he was to wed Arya Stark, but my good father Frey had no choice but to break the betrothal when King Rob betrayed him.
Is there word of Arya Stark?
Brian leaned forward.
Lady Catelyn had feared that. Is the girl still alive?
Oh, yes, said the Lord of the Dreadfort.
You have certain knowledge of that, my lord.
Roose Bolton shrugged.
Arya Stark was lost for a time, it was true, but now she has been found. I mean to see her return safely to the north.
Her and her sister both, said Brian. Tyrion Lannister has promised us both girls for his brother.
That seemed to amuse the Lord of the Dreadfort.
My lady, has no one told you? Lannisters lie.
Is that a slight on the honour of my house?
Jamie picked up the cheese knife with his good hand.
A rounded point and dull, he said, sliding his thumb along the edge of the blade. But it will go through your eye all the same.
Sweat beaded his brow. He could only hope he did not look as feeble as he felt. Lord Bolton's little smile paid another visit to his lips.
You speak boldly for a man who needs help to break his bread. My guards are all around us, I remind you.
All around us, and half a league away.
Jamie glanced down the vast length of the hall.
By the time they reach us, you'll be as dead as Ares.
'Tis scarcely chivalrous to threaten your host over his own cheese and olives, the Lord of the Dreadfort scolded.
In the north, we hold the laws of hospitality sacred still. I'm a captive here, not a guest.
Your goat cut off my hand. If you think some prunes will make me overlook that, you're bloody well mistaken.
That took Roose Bolton aback.
Perhaps I am. Perhaps I ought to make a wedding gift of you to Edmure Tully.
Or strike your head off, as your sister did for Eddard Stark.
I would not advise it. Castle Rock has a long memory.
1,000 leagues of mountain, sea, and bog lie between my walls and your rock. Lannister enmity means little to Bolton.
Lannister friendship could mean much. Jamie thought he knew the game they were playing now. But does the wench know as well?
He dare not look to see.
I am not certain you are the sort of friends a wise man would want. Roose Bolton beckoned to the boy. Elmar, carve our guests a slice off the roast. Brian was served first, but made no move to eat.
My lord, she said, Sir Jamie is to be exchanged for Lady Catelyn's daughters. You must free us to continue on our way.
The raven that came from Riveron told of an escape, not an exchange. And if you helped this captive slip his bonds, you are guilty of treason, my lady. The big wench rose to her feet.
I serve Lady Stark.
And I the king in the north, or the king who lost the north, as some now call him, who never wished to trade Sir Jamie back to the Lannisters.
Sit down and eat, Brian, Jamie urged, as Elmer placed a slice of roast before him, dark and bloody.
If Bolton meant to kill us, he wouldn't be wasting his precious prunes on us, at such peril to his bowels.
He stared at the meat and realized there was no way to cut it, one-handed.
I am worth less than a girl now, he thought. The goats even the trade. Though I doubt Lady Catelyn will thank him when Cersei returns her whelps in like condition. The thought made him grimace. I will get the blame for that as well, I'll wager.
Roose Bolton cut his meat methodically, the blood running across his plate. Lady Brian, will you sit if I tell you that I hope to send Sir Jamie on, just as you and Lady Stark desire?
You'll send us on?
The wench sounded wary, but she said,
That is good, my lord.
It is. However, Lord Vargo has created me one small difficulty. He turned his pale eyes on Jamie. Do you know why Holt cut off your hand?
He enjoys cutting off hands.
The linen that covered Jamie's stump was spotted with blood and wine.
He enjoys cutting off feet as well. He doesn't seem to need a reason.
Nevertheless, he had one. Holt is more cunning than he appears. No man commands a company such as the Brave Companions for long unless he has some wits about him. Bolton stabbed a chunk of meat with the point of his dagger, put it in his mouth, chewed thoughtfully, swallowed. Lord Vargo abandoned House Lannister because I offered him Harrenhal, a reward 1,000 times greater than any he could hope to have from Lord Tywin. As a stranger to Westeros, he did not know the prize was poisoned.
"The curse of Harren the Black," mocked Jamie.
"The curse of Tywin Lannister." Bolton held out his goblet, and Elmar refilled it silently. "Our goat should have consulted the Tarbecks or the Rains. They might have warned him how your lord father deals with betrayal."
"There are no Tarbecks or Rains," said Jamie.
"My point precisely. Lord Vargo doubtless hoped that Lord Stannis would triumph at King's Landing, and thence confirm him in his possession of this castle, in gratitude for his small part in the downfall of House Lannister." He gave a dry chuckle.
"He knows little of Stannis Baratheon either, I fear.
That one might have given him a Harrenhal for his service, but he would have given him a noose for his crimes as well.
A noose is kinder than what he'll get from my father."
By now he has come to the same realization. With Stannis broken and Renly dead, only a Stark victory can save him from Lord Tywin's vengeance, but the chances of that grow perishingly slim.
"King Rob has won every battle," Brian said stoutly, as stubbornly loyal of speech as she was of deed.
"Won every battle while losing the Freys, the Karstarks, Winterfell, and the North. A pity the wolf is so young. Boys of 16 always believe they are immortal and invincible. An older man would bend the knee, I'd think. After a war, there's always a peace, and with peace there are pardons, for the Robb Starks, at least. Not for the likes of Vargo Holt." Bolton gave him a small smile. "Both sides have made use of him, but neither will shed a tear at his passing. The Brave Companions did not fight in the Battle of the Blackwater.
yet they died there all the same. You'll forgive me if I don't mourn. You have no pity for our wretched doom-goat? Ah, but the guards must, else why deliver you into his hands? Bolton chewed another chunk of meat. Carhold is smaller and meaner than Harrenhal, but it lies well beyond the reach of the lion's claws. Once wed to Alice Carstark, Hote might be a lord in truth. If he could collect some gold from your father, so much the better. But he would have delivered you to Lord Rickart, no matter how much Lord Tywin paid. His price would be the maid and safe refuge. But to sell you, he must keep you, and the Riverlands are full of those who would gladly steal you away. Glover and Tallheart were broken at Duskendale, but remnants of their host are still abroad, with the mountain, slaughtering the stragglers. 1,000 Carstarks prowl the land south and east of River Run, hunting you. Elsewhere are Derrymen left lordless and lawless, packs of four-footed wolves, and the Lightning Lord's outlaw bands. Dondarrion would gladly hang you and the goat together from the same tree. The Lord of the Dreadfort supped up some of the blood with a chunk of bread. Harrenhal was the only place Lord Vargo could hope to hold you safe, but here his brave companions are much outnumbered by my own men, and by Sir Aenys and his Freys. No doubt he feared I might return you to Sir Edmure at Riveron, or worse, send you on to your father. By maiming you, he meant to remove your sword as a threat, gain himself a grisly token to send to your father, and diminish your value to me. For he is my man, as I am King Rob's man. Thus his crime is mine, or may seem so, in your father's eyes, and therein lies my small difficulty. He gazed at Jamie, his pale eyes unblinking, expectant, chill. I see. You want me to absolve you of blame? To tell my father that this stump is no work of yours? Jamie laughed. My lord, send me to Cersei, and I'll sing as sweet a song as you could want, of how gently you treated me. Any other answer, he knew, and Bolton would give him back to the goat. Had I a hand, I'd write it out, how I was maimed by the sellsword my own father brought to Westeros, and saved by the noble Lord Bolton. I will trust your word, sir. There's something I don't often hear. How soon might we be permitted to leave? And how do you mean to get me past all those wolves and brigands and Carstarks? You will leave when Kyburn says you are strong enough, with a strong escort of picked men under the command of my captain, Walton. Steelshanks, he is called, a soldier of iron loyalty. Walton will see you safe and whole to King's Landing.
Provided Lady Catelyn's daughters are delivered safe and whole as well, said the wench. My lord, your man Walton's protection is welcome, but the girls are my charge.
The Lord of the Dreadfort gave her an uninterested glance. The girls need not concern you any further, my lady. The Lady Sansa is the dwarf's wife. Only the guards can part them now.
His wife? Brienne said, appalled. The imp? But he swore before the whole court, in sight of guards and men.
She is such an innocent. Jamie was almost as surprised, if truth be told, but he hid it better.
Sansa Stark, that ought to put a smile on Tyrion's face.
He remembered how happy his brother had been with his little crofter's daughter for a fortnight. What the imp did or did not swear scarcely matters now, said Lord Bolton. Least of all to you. The wench looked almost wounded. Perhaps she finally felt the steel jaws of the trap when Roose Bolton beckoned to his guards. Sir Jamie will continue on to King's Landing. I said nothing about you, I fear. It would be unconscionable of me to deprive Lord Vargo of both his prizes. The Lord of the Dreadfort reached out to pick another prune.
Were I you, my lady, I should worry less about Starks, and rather more about sapphires.
Tyrion. A horse whickered impatiently behind him from amidst the ranks of gold cloaks drawn up across the road. Tyrion could hear Lord Giles coughing as well. He had not asked for Giles, no more than he had asked for Sir Adam, or Jalabar Zoe, or any of the rest, but his lord father felt Doran Martell might take it ill if only a dwarf came out to escort him across the Blackwater. Joffrey should have met the Dornishman himself, he reflected as he sat waiting, but he would have mucked it up, no doubt. Of late the king had been repeating little jests about the Dornish that he'd picked up from Mace Tyrell's men-at-arms.
How many Dornishmen does it take to shoe a horse?
9. 1 to do the shoeing, and 8 to lift the horse up. Somehow Tyrion did not think Doran Martell would find that amusing. He could see their banners flying as the riders emerged from the green of the living wood in a long, dusty column. From here to the river, only bare black trees remained, a legacy of his battle.
Too many banners, he thought sourly, as he watched the ashes kick up under the hooves of the approaching horses,
as they had beneath the hooves of the Tyrell van, as it smashed Stannis in the flank.
Martell's brought half the Lords of Dorne, by the look of it.
He tried to think of some good that might come of that, and failed.
How many banners do you count?
He asked Bronn.
The sellsword knight shaded his eyes. 8? No, 9.
Tyrion turned in the saddle.
Pod, come up here. Describe the arms you see, and tell me which houses they represent.
Podrick Payne edged his gelding closer. He was carrying the royal standard, Joffrey's great stag and lion, and struggling with its weight. Bronn bore Tyrion's own banner, the Lion of Lannister, gold on crimson.
He's getting taller,
Tyrion realized, as Pod stood in his stirrups for a better view.
He'll soon tire over me, like all the rest.
The lad had been making a diligent study of Dornish heraldry at Tyrion's command, but as ever he was nervous.
I can't see. The wind is flapping them.
Bronn, tell the boy what you see. Bronn looked very much the knight today, in his new doublet and cloak, the flaming chain across his chest.
A red sun on orange, he called, with a spear through its back.
Martell, Podrick Payne said at once, visibly relieved.
House Martell of Sunspear, my lord, the Prince of Dawn.
My horse would have known that one, said Tyrion dryly.
Give him another, Bronn. There's a purple flag with yellow balls. Lemons, Pod said hopefully, a purple field strewn with lemons, for House Dort of Lemonwood.
Might be. Next, a big black bird on yellow. Something pink or white in its claws, art to say with a banner flapping.
The vulture of Blackmont grasps a baby in its talons, said Pod. House Blackmont of Blackmont, sir.
Bronn laughed. Reading books again. Books will ruin your sword eye, boy.
I see a skull, too. A black banner.
The crown skull of House Manwoody, bone and gold on black. Pod sounded more confident with every correct answer.
The Manwoodies of Kingsgrave.
3 black spiders.
They're scorpions, sir. House Corgill of Sandstone. 3 scorpions, black on red.
Red and yellow, a jagged line between.
The flames of Hellholt. House Ulla.
Tyrion was impressed. The boy is not half stupid once he gets his tongue untied.
Go on, Pod, he urged. If you get them all, I'll make you a gift.
A pie with red and black slices, said Bronn. There's a gold hand in the middle.
House Illyrian of God's Grace.
A red chicken eating a snake, looks like.
The Gargalians of Saltshore. A cockatrice, sir, pardon, not a chicken. Red with a black snake in its beak.
Very good, exclaimed Tyrion. One more, lad. Bronn scanned the ranks of the approaching Dornishmen. The lush, a golden feather on green checks.
A golden quill, sir, Jordane of the Tor.
Tyrion laughed. Nine, and well done. I could not have named them all myself. That was a lie, but it would give the boy some pride, and that he badly needed.
Martell brings some formidable companions, it would seem.
Not one of the houses Pod had named was small or insignificant. Nine of the greatest lords of Dorne were coming up the King's Road, them or their heirs, and somehow Tyrion did not think they had come all this way just to see the Dancing Bear. There was a message here, and not one that I like. He wondered if it had been a mistake to ship Myrcella down to Sunspear.
"My lord," Pod said, a little timidly, "there's no letter."
Tyrion turned his head sharply. The boy was right.
"Doran Martell always travels in a litter," the boy said, "a carved litter with silk hangings and suns on the drapes."
Tyrion had heard the same talk. Prince Doran was past 50 and gouty. "He may have wanted to make faster time," he told himself. "He may have feared his litter would make too tempting a target for brigands, or that it would prove too cumbersome in the high passes of the Boneway. Perhaps his gout is better." So why did he have such a bad feeling about this? This waiting was intolerable.
"Banners, forward!" he snapped. "We'll meet them!"
He kicked his horse. Bronn and Pod followed, one to either side. When the Dornishmen saw them coming, they spurred their own mounts, banners rippling as they rode. From their ornate saddles were slung the round metal shields they favoured, and many carried bundles of short throwing spears, or the double-curved Dornish bows they used so well from horseback. There were three sorts of Dornishmen, the first King Daeron had observed. There were the salty Dornishmen, who lived along the coasts, the sandy Dornishmen of the deserts and long river valleys, and the stony Dornishmen who made their fastnesses in the passes and heights of the Red Mountains. The salty Dornishmen had the most roynish blood, the stony Dornishmen the least. All three sorts seemed very well represented in Doran's retinue. The salty Dornishmen were lithe and dark, with smooth olive skin and long black hair streaming in the wind. The sandy Dornishmen were even darker, their faces burned brown by the hot Dornish sun. They wound long bright scarves around their helms to ward off sunstroke. The stony Dornishmen were the biggest and fairest, sons of the Andals and the First Men, brown-haired or blond, with faces that freckled or burned in the sun instead of browning. The lords wore silken satin robes with jewelled belts and flowing sleeves. Their armour was heavily enamelled and inlaid with burnished copper, shining silver, and soft red gold. They came astride red horses and golden ones, and a few as pale as snow, all slim and swift, with long necks and narrow, beautiful heads. The fabled sand steeds of Dorn were smaller than proper war horses, and could not bear such weight of armour, but it was said they could run for a day and night and another day and never tire. The Dornish leader forked a stallion black as sin, with a mane and tail the colour of fire. He sat his saddle as if he'd been born there, tall, slim, graceful. A cloak of pale red silk fluttered from his shoulders, and his shirt was armoured with overlapping rows of copper discs that glittered like a thousand bright new pennies as he rode. His high gilded helm displayed a copper sun on its brow, and the round shield slung behind him bore the sun and spear of House Martell on its polished metal surface. "A Martell son, but 10 years too young," Tyrion thought as he reined up. "Too fit as well, and far too fierce." He knew what he must deal with by then. "How many Dornishmen does it take to start a war?" he asked himself. "Only one." Yet he had no choice but to smile. "Well met, my lords. We had word of your approach, and His Grace King Joffrey bid me ride out to welcome you in his name. My lord father, the king's son, sends his greetings as well." He feigned an amiable confusion. "Which of you is Prince Doran?"
My brother's health requires he remain at Sunspear.
The princeling removed his helm. Beneath his face was lined and sat